Folks, anybody hearing me?
About the same.
Yeah. That'd be nice. Hello.
I'm not on.
I can talk really loud because this microphone's not working. The Cospel, the Coalition of Senate Faculty Leadership is meeting Monday at 12:30 in Frankfort with the Council on Post-Secondary Education. And I asked her to put my email address up so that if you all have anything you'd like for me to bring up, there's a lot going on with budgets and everything in the state. So if you all would like me to bring up anything with the CPE, just send me an email and I'll bring it up at that meeting on Monday in Frankfort.
Advisory reports, Dr. Minter.
As you've read in the press, the Board of Regents met on the day of the ice storm, gavelling to order late, and we had a very reduced crowd. In fact, it's probably the smallest board meeting I've ever attended. Seven regents present. The major issue was, of course, the contract for Katrina, which passed by a margin of 6-1. You know, I voted against that, and we heard the comments that I made. It's sort of, the meeting in many ways is anticlimactic because there was no discussion on the agenda item, and I provided the discussion. But there was no discussion on the other thing that was left unspoken, which was that we heard a report from enrollment management that didn't actually produce any hard numbers. So the board has not been informed of any hard numbers for enrollment for spring 13. And I'll be looking forward to receiving that data as soon as it is made available to us. But certainly what it seems to suggest is are some enrollment issues. I think anybody who teaches on campus is aware of that. And it is a reminder that financial difficulties are upon us. So to sort of quickly circle back to what we talked about last month, as faculty members, as senators, as part of the shared governance system, we all need to actively participate in conversations whenever we have the opportunity, and we need to remind all constituencies that we need to resist any attempts to continue funding entertainment or to fund non-essentials when the academic mission is paramount. And when there are challenging budget times, it's unfortunate that sometimes that we have to make that argument. But it is one that cannot be done by one person in a regency. It can't be done by one person who is a chair of the body or a chair of a committee. It's the kind of thing that has to be said repeatedly at every level by every faculty member and every student leader who cares about the academic mission and what a university should be. There are a lot of things that are really nice to have. Those are, you know, I like fun things, I like pretty shiny things, but we need to remember that preserving what the essence of the university is what's really important, and many voices are always stronger than one voice. So as I receive more information, I will of course keep you in the loop, and as always, I thank you for your great support, and I thank you for always being such excellent communicators with me, and you know where to find me. Thank you.
Okay, we had about six recommendations last time. All were approved with a minor clarification of the Graduate Council report. Some of the program course approvals had a winter start date, and that was not very possible, but one of the recommendations received, they were moved to summer. Student identity and distance learning courses policy was passed by AC, is on the web. Ditto the time for hours of credit, which has great bearing on our sanctuary affirmation, that's on the web as well. And the two courses for the Colonnade Foundations program, that was recognition approved as well. On the subject of SACs, we are progressing toward a compliance report. We should do again in September 2014. Your department heads will be getting pre populated faculty rosters for fall of 13 fairly shortly. Course assignments have been made. Now we're asking the department heads to go back and verify what credentials they would put on those faculty rosters each and every course. So I expect those discussions to start happening in the next month or so. There'll be more policies forthcoming. SACS requires us to have a substantial number of policies that we currently need to be working on a little bit. Policies on academic program review, policies on faculty credentials. The good news, I guess, if you like it, is SACS substantially reduced its burden on reporting what's called substantial change. It used to be any time there was a substantial change, you had to get approval from SACS in advance before the change could occur. And last year, I know that our doctor physical therapy program was sitting in SACS for several months awaiting approval, that being a substantial change in the doctoral program. The reason it sat there was SACS, I believe, had over 300 substantial change requests pending. They've lightened that somewhat. For example, now if you are authorized to do distance learning courses, which WKU is, you're no longer required to get substantial change authorization to offer courses in another. Distance learning courses in another area. Distance learning is distance learning. That should reduce the burden quite a bit. Chair mentioned the QEP. There are two quality enhancement plan ideas, if you like, for the group. Whether or not you select or advocate one or the other or some amalgamation of the two, it's up to you. One is on writing and communication, and the other is on mastery of information. I'm going to leave the two kind of blend together, therefore I encourage you to engage in discussions with that. As Doug points out in his article, our last QEP, Engaging Citizens in a Global Learning Context, has worked extremely well for the campus, and we expect our next QEP to do the same. Now, at the last meeting, there was a resolution of the Senate on the advocacy for increased bio term instruction, and I have a prepared statement to read on that. Call this response to Senate resolution with increased emphasis on bi-term teaching at WKU. I've appreciated the opportunity to discuss with many of you over a series of college forums the possibility of WKU moving to an increased emphasis on bi-term instruction. It is clear from these discussions and from other input I've received that an overwhelming majority of faculty and students do not support a deliberate, systemic move toward an increased emphasis on bi-term instruction at WKU. Many points arguing against such a systemic move have been made. Amongst those are the lack of an adequate precedent at other higher education institutions, and so the corresponding high level of risk involved in making such a change. Two, the need in many courses for an extended period of time for students to reflect and to prepare meaningful written assignments. Similar considerations for courses that involve clinical experiences. The increased impact of missed days or weeks due to sickness and so forth. The suitability of the current predominantly semester-based course calendar for students who are employed. The complicated scheduling logistics that will be associated with a substantially increased number of bi-term courses offered in parallel with traditional semester-length courses. The increased stress, both on individuals, students, faculty, and staff, and on the institution of more frequent final examinations, term starts and ends, the loss of the important fifth-week assessment instrument, and the possible negative impact on student enrollment and retention at a time when these issues are paramount. Some months ago, the Student Government Association passed a resolution arguing against any systemic change to the academic calendar that reflects the five-term structure. And as I said at this last meeting, the Senate also passed a resolution arguing against, quote, a change to the academic calendar to privilege delivery, close quote, of classes in a bi-term mode. So it is clear from all the above that the deliberate campus-wide move toward increased bi-term instruction is not in the overall interests of our students and faculty. Therefore, WKU will continue to offer courses predominantly in the semester-based format. This outcome notwithstanding, I believe the opportunity for reflection, discussion, and debate on this issue has generated an increased awareness of how academic course content is packaged and how best to use precious class time. Several aspects of this, I believe, merit mention at this juncture. In cases where it is believed that significant advantage in pedagogical effectiveness would result, I would still encourage faculty and units to explore teaching courses in accelerated bi-term mode during fall and spring semesters. And indeed, several units have indicated they do plan to explore the enhanced use of this already available accelerated learning mode. However, care must be taken to ensure the overall integrity of class schedules for students who do participate in bi-term classes is maintained. Second, the growing level of participation in our summer and winter course offerings indicates that enhancement of these additional opportunities for learning may be beneficial. Many students take advantage of winter and summer term courses not only to accelerate their progress toward a degree, but also to engage in enriching experiences such as study abroad. Third, as the various means through which information is transferred, through which knowledge is acquired, and through which learning is accomplished continue to evolve, there are other important changes in the higher education landscape that merit our close attention. Some of these changes are gradual, some not so gradual. In the latter category, the rapidly increasing availability of massive open online courses or MOOCs, which offer higher education content to a wide audience, usually at no charge, clearly pose both an opportunity and a threat to learning in traditional university context. As an institution, we need to be formulating how to respond to such rapidly evolving elements in the higher education landscape, and I therefore encourage you all to be thinking seriously about how to address these issues. Fourth, there is considerable evidence that for online courses in which students working at their own pace can, and often do, comfortably complete material within a duration significantly shorter than a semester, there may still be distinct advantages to offering courses more frequently or even on an on-demand basis. Such a model may be a distinct attraction to the population of adult learners who desire to return to complete degrees in order to advance their career. It is likely that such adult learners will form an increasingly important element of our enrollment profile in the future, and we must be willing to be increasingly flexible in our course delivery modes in response to this changing demography. In closing, I would like to recall my request in early fall that campus give the idea of increased bi-term course offerings a fair shake. And I am appreciative, very appreciative, this is indeed what has occurred. I would like to thank you all for giving the bi-term concept such a fair, thoughtful consideration, and I look forward to a similar level of campus engagement in future initiatives.
Various committees and their members for the due diligence that they did. I think we did give this a fair shake. They did it the right way. And I appreciate it with all that help from the Senate. Great.
I only have a couple things that I'd like to update you about this afternoon. As you may be aware, a resolution was introduced into the Student Senate regarding the plus minus grading scale. That was supposed to be up for a vote this past Tuesday, however, it was temporarily postponed. There are ongoing discussions on this issue, and I'll be sure to keep this body updated on that. Preserving the faculty-student alliance is always a top priority. The Student Government Association, that is really true on this particular issue. Second, I'd just like to let you know that our study abroad scholarship applications for summer and fall are currently online, and the deadline for that is quickly approaching. I just encourage you to make your students aware of this and other financial resources, because I think students now more than ever need those opportunities. Thanks.
Graduate Council report.
Move to approve the Graduate Council report dated January 2013 with two minor exceptions. One, with the provost encountered, I've encountered was like reference 131 down under section 6. That should have a date change to summer 13 for the effective date. I think it had spring, obviously, won't work. And I'd also like to pull the Master of Arts in Math reference 049 from the
I can
This is graduate faculty only. Any questions, discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Undergraduate curriculum?
Move to approve the report.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Old business. This was the department head slash chair's policy that we took up last meeting. Was tabled with an amendment.
I'd like to ask if possible to withdraw that tabled amendment. Is there any objection to that? I prepared another amendment that I'd like to share with you.
The way I understand this, Robert, the way I understand this is an email that you sent me.
I sent it on.
Briefly, it's a protocol.
Yeah. Oh. Should have paid attention. There are two ways we can deal with this. One, the easiest is if there's no objection, simply allow him to withdraw the amendment he proposed last meeting and put forward a new amendment. The harder of a way, but maybe more orthodox, is if somebody objects to his withdrawing the motion, we have a vote on the amendment. Should it fail, then he can propose the new amendment. But I would suggest we just allow the amendment on the meeting.
Without objection. Your previous amendment is now full. Now,
thank you.
Before you do anything else, we're back to the original policy now as submitted to the body last meeting. And so I need a motion for approval.
So, okay. And I'll second that.
Okay, yeah. Very good.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to introduce a new amendment, and it does two things. It says that the department head search committee chair should ideally have department chair experience. That the search committee should work independently from the hiring official until they place the report. And then also that the department chair, whether permanent or temporary, should have tenure, ideally in that department. So really there's three things. Heads of department head search committees should have ideally some previous experience themselves. That department head search committees should be able to operate independently from the hiring official, meaning the dean, until they place their report. And then finally, that department chairs should have tenure, preferably in the department.
Can we split this? Would the amender consider splitting that into two amendments, as they are seemingly unrelated?
Yeah, that seems very reasonable. I certainly wouldn't object. So, two amendments. Then the first one having to do. The first portion of the amendment then would have to do with the setting up of the department head search committee, which would be paragraph 5.
So the split is paragraph 5 and then paragraph.
And then the rest, 6 and one tiny bit of 6D.
Okay. So we'll deal with discussion of First Amendment, section 5.
Okay.
So keep your remarks to. Section 5.
You see, am I in the way?
I'd be very happy to answer questions you have.
Any questions about this?
Yeah. Does this represent a change in the current policy?
That's what we already do.
Well, may I speak to that? In most departments, that
yes.
I don't want to pick a fight with this. Let me preface what I'm going to say by that. But in most departments, that is the case. A week before the semester started, the head of the psychology department was removed. He still doesn't know why. His interim replacement does not know why. And the faculty of the psychology department do not fully understand it yet either. That person was replaced with an untenured faculty member from another department. This is something that's happened already. We don't want it to happen to anybody else. And since it seems logic would suggest this is the way, as written here, that we do things, it seems that it would be nice to get it down on paper for everybody's convenience, if you will. Section 5, currently the...
Section 6.
Thank you. In Section 5, the person appointed to head the committee did not have chair experience. And further in Section 5, the dean not only initially met with the hiring committee, but was on the schedule for subsequent hiring committee meetings. That search has been terminated since, so we have yet to see if the dean would have been present at subsequent search committee meetings. But it seems prudent to simply say, ideally, search committees ought to be able to work independently until they render their report. It's bizarre, I know.
Oh, I wouldn't say bizarre. Dr. Dowd?
I sympathize with the goal of the amendment, but I think there's a problem with the wording. The hiring official shall have no input in the search committee deliberations until such point as the committee findings are presented. Because in any hiring process, there's a thing called Form 2 that has to be forwarded to the hiring official to look at the candidates and raise questions at that point and send it back. So the wording, I don't know, it needs to be tweaked because would that exclude the hiring official from, in this case, the dean, having the say on Form 2, which is part of the process now?
Would Form 2 be considered part of the committee's findings?
Well, it's when you forward the candidate you want to interview, just like in a faculty search.
To me, that seems like an output of what the committee is recommending.
Okay. I just want a clarification because if you read that strictly, that would suggest the hiring official would have no say on that. Yeah.
Would a solution be to change it until such point as each stage of the committee findings are presented to account for those different stages of the process?
I have no objection to that.
Is there any other discussion?
Aaron, does that still account for the intent of the resolution?
It certainly captures the intent of the resolution. Thank you.
Yes.
I may be missing something here. I understand I'm somewhat aware of the situation that he's talking about, but I'm not sure I see the relevance between what has happened in the psych department already and Section 5 of this, which is about the search department, the search committee, not the process of removal of a sitting or the appointment of an interim. I'm not sure I see the relevance of those.
A number of people in the department have seen the composition of the leadership of the search committee and the way in which the search committee seemed to be being handled as an extension of the opaque reasoning that led to the removal of the department head. That's how we see them as related, and that's why we felt something should be said under Section 5 as well.
Any other questions? Discussion? All those in favor of supporting the First Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Let's go on to Amendment 2.5. Aaron?
Again, I'm happy to answer any questions. We're simply saying that we feel a department head or chair should hold tenure, and ideally that should be in the department, and that should apply both to permanent and interim department heads.
Yes.
So accepted.
So I guess my concern here is that the way I read this, it implies that you value tenure overall more highly than tenure within department. And I would actually reverse the priorities for myself and say that, in fact, if you consider, for example, a department where perhaps there's not an eligible tenured faculty member to serve as department head, that in fact the way it's written originally, that except in unusual circumstances, a department head chair should hold tenure in the department, that that values department membership above tenure standing. And I think in that sense I would say that I oppose this amendment. I think elsewhere in the policy it says that people holding the same rank or higher have to vote on whether the person gets tenure, so that's not really here. We don't need to worry about that, I don't think.
Yes. This is a friendly amendment. I think it would satisfy some of this. Would be if we just got rid of, if we just said the department head should hold tenure in the department. Just get rid of everything. Yeah.
I love that idea. However, right now we have an untenured faculty member from another department serving as our interim head.
Yeah,
Oh, I see.
And yeah, I should have been born. A lot of times you do that. People who are very near tenure to our right person with jobs.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Angeli,
is that a question to me?
Well, it's a question you can answer, and I thought you had your hand.
Okay, so, well, I did for a different matter, but let me understand that there's two parts here to this. Part six, as I understand it, does not relate to any search at all. It just says the department head should hold tenure, and I would like to point out we have current department heads who don't. And what would happen to them if this amendment was passed? Are we grandfather them in? Do we suddenly declare them ineligible to be department heads? Now, for interim, I think that's different. But the question is, if you make a hire, we have current department head, at least one I can think of, possibly more, that is not tenured.
I think we're missing interims.
Well, that's why I'm confused why we're talking about paragraph 6 or paragraph D.
Yes.
Hmm?
Well, 6 is not a good interim.
The dean or whomever feels that there is no tenured faculty member in the department that should be an interim. If there's internal department stuff going on that makes that not a good thing.
Yeah,
that's an unusual circumstance.
Yeah. Is there any new angles? Okay. So now we're voting on the second part of the Second Amendment.
Now the second part is that point six.
Andy. It's six and D.
Different.
I think that we went back to should rather than
should.
State we should rather than shall. Yes.
Can I just point out that the language of should, it really doesn't make it binding at all.
I think that's why.
But that was exactly my point. If you make it binding, we disenfranchise at least one department head as of today.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we want a unbinding policy. Hell, we're glad to have it.
Matt?
Yes, Robert.
I don't know. Forgive me, I did not realize in our discussion we were lumping number 6 and paragraph D together. Because in D, I have no problem with having the interim department head holding tenure, but I was just trying to, I think every interim head in Potter College in the last 10 years has been from outside of the department, and there's been no crisis or turmoil. And if this is passed, then that would, what standard practice in Potter would suddenly become extraordinary, only in extraordinary circumstances. So I can support 6, and I can support part of D, but I can't support where it must be from that department, because that's not the way we've done business. I mean, to open the possibility of other ways, fine.
Would tenure should preferably be held in the department? So, what should hold tenure, period, tenure should preferably be held in the department? Or tenure would preferably be held in the department?
I think what he's saying is he's okay with this, but he's not okay with this.
Yes, and that's what I meant. I meant to amend the second clause, comma, tenure should not be held, excuse me, department should hold tenure, and now I want to replace, and except in unusual circumstances, I'd like to replace that with tenure would preferably be held in the department. And that's more gentle than should, and doesn't. And I'm moving to strike except in unusual circumstances. So it's two sentences: a period after tenure, and then strike and except in unusual circumstances.
And then also the sentence after.
Yes. So that entire sentence, that entire clause, gets replaced with the sentence in red. How do you guys feel about that?
Yes. At this stage, how is this different from the original wording?
Let's see. I'd have to pull that up. So, except, okay, so that's six. Go up a little bit, please. Okay. And then what we've got is... Okay, so that's the original. And then let's see... We see six there. Now let's see the modified six. Well, that would be an incapacity. Is there an incapacity statement in the original?
The answer is yes. All that's changed is the boldface has been added.
Yeah, so the change there... Okay, so 6D, which is a little lower. It's under reassignment. Okay, so that's incapacity and temporary. And so we've got, in our suggestion, we have the original... with the change of the bolded.
So in the original, there's no mention of where they should come from?
Yeah, or that they be tenured.
Okay. That's the end of discussion. We'll take a vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Nay.
Nay.
The ayes have. Guys, hands please. Resolution.
earlier this month at the SEC meeting, the International Education Committee shared with us a document that outlined a discussion that had been ongoing between the IEC and the Study Abroad Office regarding the possible implementation of a new $150 study abroad fee. Those discussions were inconclusive, according to this document, as of January 23rd, 2013. But on the 30th of January, 2013, an email from Study Abroad was sent out, written by Dr. Cobain, that announced the implementation of the fee. Broadly speaking, many faculty are concerned with the rising costs of study abroad and the impact that that has on accessibility by our students. But what we all concluded, it seems to me, at the SEC meeting, that the timing of this fee puts those that lead study abroad trips in a bind, because virtually all study abroad trips had been priced out long before the 30th of January. So when these trips are advertised for students, they're advertised, this will cost X amount of dollars to take this trip for this amount of credits. Students had already begun to sign up for these trips, and then all of a sudden, out of the blue comes this $150 extra fee that faculty had to answer for, and students understandably felt misled. So what this recommendation does is it asks the Study Abroad Office to postpone any implementation of this fee until the next calendar year, until the fall, so that students have knowledge of the fee, and so that those that plan study abroad trips have knowledge of the fee when they price out their programs. Again, accessibility is a broader issue that I think we need to do more to remedy. But for the time being, we hope that this gives both the IEC and the Study Abroad Office perhaps some time to discuss the matter further. And at the very least, I think it's only fair to students to postpone this until they have a chance to take it into account before they decide whether or not to take a study abroad trip, and so that faculty have a chance to take it into account as they plan out and price the trips that they offer. So I move that the Senate accept this recommendation.
Just for clarification, there was discussion at the SEC meeting about this, but this resolution is not coming out of the SEC, and it's not coming out of academic quality. Guy was kind enough as a senator to draft the language.
Matt from Sociology, thanks, Guy, for doing this. Just to add another point here, for the Sweet Five Stars in October, we accept students into the program in October, the range of first $100. We told also once you pay your deposit, if you exceed that cost, you can drop out and get your deposit back and so forth. And so this could potentially push costs above your point of cost, and also make them able to get their deposit back and all that. So a lot of problems with this. Appreciate this being on board.
Sure, any other discussion? So we have a motion and a second. All those in favor of supporting your recommendation, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Is there any other new business? I think we need to entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.